and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, owner of Four Season Farm in Harborside, Maine, Elliot Coleman. He gave the keynote address at this year's Alaska Botanical Garden Conference. Extending the season, if we can do it in Maine, you can do it in Alaska, was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on Friday, March 9th.
During his careers as a commercial market gardener, the director of agricultural research projects, and as a teacher and lecturer on organic gardening, he studied, practiced, and perfected his craft. So he served for 2 years as the executive director of the International Federation of Organic Agriculture Movements and was an advisor to the USDA during their landmark 1979-80 study report and recommendations on organic farming. He's conducted study tours of organic farms, market gardens, orchards, and vineyards in Europe and has successfully combined European ideas with his own to develop and popularize a complete system of tools and equipment for organic vegetable growers. He shares that expertise through his lectures and writings and has served as a tool consultant to a number of companies, including Johnny's Selected Seeds. With his wife Barbara, he's the host of the TV series Gardening Naturally on the Learning Channel. He and Barbara presently operate a commercial year-round market garden in addition to horticultural research projects at Four Season Farm in Harborside, Maine. And I have a little aside, in case any of you are skeptical about Elliot's Alaskan credibility, here's a little known aspect of his resume. Apparently in 1964, Elliot and some friends came up to Talkeetna from where they went with renowned bush pilot Don Sheldon, who flew them out to the Yukon, where they succeeded in accomplishing the first ascent of the North Ridge of Mount Logan, which they subsequently named Independence Ridge, since they summited on July 4th. And it sounds like it was a typical hardcore Alaskan adventure, complete with plenty of extreme conditions, crevasse falls, bears, river crossings, and no injuries. So welcome, Elliot. I think that makes you a true honorary Alaskan in our book.
I don't know who that was she was talking about. I first learned of Alaska when I was a little kid. My father was stationed in Attu during the war, and I can remember my mother telling me that there were ropes tied between the buildings because the wind blew so hard that they had to hold on to something while they were trying to go from one place to another. I put this slide up here first just because people up here need to realize that we actually have winter in Maine. That's snow on either side of the greenhouse. And the reason I put it up is every other time I've talked about what we're doing, I'm talking to people who are further south than where I am. It's one of the reasons I accepted this invitation, actually. And I knew that if we had started what we do and our farm was in Virginia, everybody north of us would have said, well, yeah, they could do it in Virginia, but you'd never be able to do it here. Well, since we were further north than everybody, nobody could say that. And you guys are the only guys further north than us, so I figured it was a challenge to come up here and see if I could talk about it up here, talk about what we do. Just some slides of our farm. We grow herbs and vegetables. This is all on land that was all wooded when I got there in 1968, and we've now cleared 14 acres of it. That we had about 3.5 inches of very poor topsoil, lots of rocks. We've managed to turn an acre and a half of that into absolutely beautiful soil that will grow almost anything we want it to grow, starting with the seedlings in the spring, moving on into harvests of beautiful crops, which we sell to all the local markets. I've always thought vegetables were as pretty a way to decorate the landscape as anything, because of all their colors and everything, and the incredible amount of nutrition that you can produce on a small area of land. But despite all of that, the thing I always wanted more than anything else was to be producing in the middle of the winter. And I wanted to be producing in the middle of the winter without wasting any resources. Everybody says, oh yeah, all you have to do is put heat in the greenhouse, and that's true. If you put heat in the greenhouse, there is absolutely nothing you can't grow. The only problem with it is the economic problem. Putting heat in the greenhouse is a very slippery slope. If you heat it just above freezing, you can grow this list of crops. But if you heat it to 45, you can grow this list. And if you heat it to 65, you can grow this list. And the next thing I know, I'm Maine's largest mango grower. And I'm in chapter 11. So we knew that was the direction in which we didn't want to go. And we wanted to figure out what we could do in unheated greenhouses with hardy crops. Our models were in Paris between about 1830 and 1900. And during that period, 6% of the land area of Paris was actually covered with market gardens. And I have books by some of these old growers. And if you go to the address that the book mentions, where the farm was, there's an apartment building there today. But they were doing a very successful job, and they were growing under these large bell jars, which they got from the early physics labs, where these things were used to do experiments on vacuum, where you could suck the air out of that jar and watch what was going on inside. And they would have up to six lettuces under one of those. And you vented these by putting a little prop under there during the day when the sun was shining. And if you can imagine that some of these growers had 3,000 of these glass bell jars, there was a lot of handwork going on. And at night, if it was going to get cold, they would protect them by rolling straw mats out under them and over them. And that they were feeding all of Paris fresh vegetables all winter. And by using hotbeds, which is manure, under some of these things, they could have melons and cucumbers in May. Well, this was a wonderful model. And when I was there on a visit in 1974, I found some growers who were still using some of this technology. They had gotten rid of the glass bell jars and moved on to cold frames. They were still rolling the mats out at night. So I went home and I said, okay, if they can do it, we can do it. And we started experimenting around with the system, which was even more modern at that time, which is what the Dutch were doing. And this was in low frames like this. And we built a whole bunch of these and we're preparing the soil. And this is fall. We've transplanted lettuce into them by about the middle of October. And in other ones, we had carrots that we planted back the 1st of August, and we filled the frame with straw to insulate them. We put the glass back on, and little snow came. There was no problem at all. And we found, my gosh, with just this little bit, this is taking place in Massachusetts, we can do wonders, because there it was, the February 11th of 1981, and the carrots that we planted the 1st of August, covered with straw and put the glass on, the tops on them had remained green under there, and we were actually selling bunched baby carrots on the 11th of February from outdoor beds that just covered with glass. And this picture was taken on the 28th of January. Those little lettuces you saw had survived very nicely under there. We were harvesting and selling them by the middle of March, at which point we put in transplants of cucumbers and other crops. So we said, okay, this is a system. We are going to figure out how to commercialize this. And of course, then reality strikes. This was a 3-foot snowstorm, and we said, okay, this seemed like a good idea, but we're not the types who are going to give up. There must be some way we can figure out how to make this work. And the next step was to put the cold frames inside hoop houses. And this was truly the great leap forward, because what it turned out that one level of covering, either just the cold frame or just the hoop house, moves the covered area about 500 miles to the south on the east coast. So outside, where you see that cart, I'm in Maine. Inside the greenhouse, I'm in New Jersey, a place you only want to go metaphorically, I can assure you. And if you reach your hand under the glass in there, your hand is in Georgia. And we had computerized thermometers, a little more modern than this, and we found out that was exactly what was going on. And this was all for free, there was no heat, but by putting the small greenhouse inside the larger greenhouse, which we did with the cold frame inside the hoop house, we were able to harvest during the winter a wide range of crops. No tomatoes, no peppers, no eggplants, but plenty of spinach and baby leaf lettuce and Swiss chard and scallions and carrots and all sorts of wonderful crops. But it was putting the second layer there that really made this work. And the next thought everybody immediately has, oh, if that works so well, and you got down to Georgia with two layers, why don't you put on a third layer and, you know, a fourth layer, we can be down in Costa Rica. The trouble with that is each layer of covering you put on cuts out about 10% of the light. And too many more layers and you wouldn't have enough light, so we were pretty content with what we had done at that point. What we did then was decide this works so well, we can do this commercially. All of that early work was done in our home garden and just playing around. Cold frames were a great idea back in the 19th century and are still fun in your backyard, but they would be very expensive on the scale we wanted to operate. So for the inner layer, we chose one of the many spun bonded fabrics that farmers are using now to add a little protection. They're wonderful, they let air, light, and moisture pass. And we supported them on little wire wickets. So they're over every 4 feet down the beds there. There is a little wire wicket holding up sheets of this fabric. That this one happens to be called Agrabon. A lot of people refer to these fabrics as Remay. Remay was the name of one of the earliest products. It's a little bit like calling all tissues Kleenex. But there are plenty of these, and all of a sudden we found that on a large scale we could do this, and it was amazingly successful. And so here we are harvesting all winter long. It is winter, there's snow, and with that inner layer inside the greenhouse, we're bringing out buckets of spinach and other crops like this all winter long. Anyway, there's a slide in here somewhere of us shoveling tons of snow off of these greenhouses, but it seems to have disappeared, so we'll get back to where we were. That's the one work in the winter, because snow slides down the south side of the greenhouse and mounds up, and we need to shovel it off. In fact, that's what happened there in order to keep going. But small problem. At this point, everybody said, well, you really can't do this because you don't have enough light in the winter. The days are too short. And we said, well, we're going to take a research trip. And we're going to go across Europe on the 44th parallel of latitude, which is the parallel where our farm is. Because Europe has this nice, milder climate. We send the Gulf Stream over there. They have the Mediterranean. And when the friends heard about this trip, they said, oh gosh, you'll have some great skiing in Oslo. And we said, well, here's the fact. Europe is actually so much further north on the planet than the North American continent, that the 44th parallel of latitude, which runs through Harborside, Maine, runs through southern France. And it also runs just south of the city of Genoa on the Mediterranean in Italy. And if you've ever been to Genoa, there are palm trees in Genoa. And this picture is taken on the terraced hillsides, the Romans terraced these, just outside of Genoa. in the middle of January, I'm talking to a little Genoese farmer there, and we went and visited a lot of these farmers, and you can see that he is growing everything outdoors in the middle of January, and we said to these farmers, well, golly, is this possible? Is there enough light? And they all said, oh yeah, there's plenty of daylight. The problem is the cold. And at that point, we would break into peals of riotous laughter, and we would say, yeah, you guys ain't seen nothing from cold. Well, what we learned as we experimented with all of this is that we do have plenty of light to grow these salad crops, but that the fact that made the difference was once day length dropped below 10 hours, plant growth slowed way down. And for us on the 44th parallel, the 10-hour day begins around the 7th or 8th of November and runs till about the 6th or 7th of February. And we called this the Persephone months. And if you remember your Greek myths, Persephone was Demeter's daughter. Demeter was the goddess of growing plants and grains and everything. And Persephone, this is every mother's greatest fear, had an affair with Hades. And wanted to go, actually he kidnapped her and took her to live with him in the netherworld. And Demeter was so upset by this that she threatened to shut down all plant growth in the world. And so Zeus brokered a deal by which Persephone would spend the few winter months in Hades with her boyfriend and the rest of the time up in the world with mom. And so that explains why there are these low-growing, slow-growing, short days in the winter by virtue of Greek myth. So during the Persephone period, we can harvest, but the key is we need to have planted the plants back in the fall when there was still growth. And we'll take spinach as an example. Our spinach planting date is about the 15th of September. We plant then out of doors, and I will show you in a minute how we do this out of doors. And then we cover the plants sometime in early November. We get the first harvest from those plants in Thanksgiving, and we get four more harvests during the winter until it's spring, and we pull out the now going to seed spinach plants, and we put in something else. During that time, if I were to put a seed in the ground, the spinach seed would sprout, but it would grow very, very slowly because we're below the 10-hour day. But the established plants that have a good root system keep pumping out leaves, and that was what we learned to make it all work. Now, we wanted to do even better because there is a greenhouse right there filled with a really vigorous, healthy tomato crop. We have to grow our tomatoes in greenhouses on the coast of Maine because our summers are so cool. And they're going to remain in there until about the middle, probably third week in October, before we'll get cold enough weather to freeze them out. But we'd like to plant our spinach. Well, we don't want to rip out the tomatoes, so what we got into was playing around with movable greenhouses, because we want this to look like that in the winter, filled with spinach, and yet we want to keep harvesting tomatoes. What that got us into was experimenting with whether we could have a system whereby we had two places where the greenhouse lived, and it spent a year here, and then it moved there, it spent a year here, and it moved there. And this was our first movable greenhouse prototype. A couple of neighbors helping me. It sat on the same posts you drive into the ground when you put up a normal hoop house, but we had a ball bearing caster in the top of each post so the house would slide along. And we could pull it with ropes. The angle iron rail on the bottom of the house rolled on that ball bearing caster, and this was our first attempt, but it was like all beginnings, it was crude, but it worked. It was an interesting experiment. And then we got more and more into it. And this is another house, and you can see that instead of the hoops being in pipes in the ground, they sit on, they're attached to a, this is a 2x3 galvanized pipe. with little attachment stubs where the hoops go. And we rigged these houses up so on the front of them, we could slide a little steel ski tip when we were ready to move them, so they would slide over the ground. And it's now moving day. This is a 30 foot wide by 100 foot long greenhouse. And you will notice that the doors are sideways along there. So those can open up. The people door in the center comes out, and the whole end of that greenhouse is then open. And we hook it up to my little tractor. And there is a cable going down this side to an anchor on the corner and over to the tractor, and a cable going down this side to an anchor and over the tractor. So the pull is straight down the side. And we've harvested and taken out the tomatoes that grew there during the summer. We're about to cover the crops that need protection for the winter. We decided at the start it would be nice to have water and electricity in there. So they come out of the ground right here, and that has been inside this end of the greenhouse. The greenhouse, as it moves down here, will stop just before it gets there. So that 2-foot strip is common to the greenhouse in both positions, and we have power and water in there. And as I tow it down, you can see this from the road by our farm. And we could always see cars squealing to a halt, because something this big moving across the field is not something you normally see. It turned out it was very easy to do. And the other thing we learned was that when it was in place, you wanted to make sure it was attached solidly to the ground. We have 4,000 pound screwed in anchors that it's chained to. I can guarantee you that something the size of a small barn wafting toward you on a stiff breeze is unnerving enough that you want to make sure that if you do play with this technology, you have your movable greenhouse anchored down. We decided that that was a nice system, but we could do even better. And I had noticed that there was a big plant nearby that had a chain link fence around it. If you've ever seen the gates on chain link fence, they have wheels that roll on a sideways pipe. So we bought those wheels, and we bought the pipe, and we attached a wheel to the bottom of each hoop, and we had a very easily movable greenhouse, but we had to do one other thing. You notice the earlier design where the hoops came down and were attached to stubs on the pipe on the ground. This one is standing there like a spider. And so in order to keep it strong, we put trusses up above so the thing isn't going to fall one way or the other. And this house now, we had a house that actually made 6 moves during the summer, or during the year, because it only needed to be there when the crop underneath it needed the protection. So let's say I've been harvesting spinach under it during the winter, and it's now the middle of March, and by the middle of March with us, the spinach only needs a single layer of protection. So we could slide this house off next door and start another crop under it, and when that crop was off and running, we could slide it again. And in the rotation, you can see there, we found that we were actually getting 24 months of use out of that greenhouse every 12 months compared to what it would have been able to yield if we'd have to leave the crops in there from start to finish. This house, since we move it frequently, is anchored down far more casually, just with these T-posts driven in, but that works well. But even with this wheel system, we said, okay, we used to have to pull this with a tractor. Now we have a house that we can pull with just 2 good, strong people with ropes really putting their back into it. But can we do even better? And working with a company in Kansas City called Four Season Tools, we came up with this system where there is this V-track that sits on the ground, and the bottom of the greenhouse has wheels like that. And this system, you have the track anchored to the ground. There's anchors driven in, and then you anchor the greenhouse to the track. So this was really a great step forward, but the best part of it was this house moves that easily. This is a 50-foot long, 30-foot wide house, and there's one old white-haired guy and one of his young helpers, and we are just rolling that down the track to cover a carrot crop. Why do we want to cover a carrot crop? This is probably the most popular vegetable we sell on our farm. And if you remember when we were first learning this game, we planted carrots on the 1st of August and then put straw and the frame over them. What we learned was if you leave carrots in the ground with the roots intact, as the weather gets colder and colder, the carrots get sweeter and sweeter. I believe they're turning some of their starch to sugar, almost like antifreeze, to protect themselves against the cold. And the carrots we harvest from here are known as candy carrots in our local neighborhood. And little children ask their parents to go buy them at the store. In fact, parents have told us that our carrots are the trading item of choice in local grade school lunchboxes. So this is something, if you can get little kids eating carrots, and it's purely understanding what happens to them when they store in the ground as opposed to storing in a cellar. I just threw in another movable greenhouse here for the home gardeners. This shows you can have fun with all sorts of weird little things if you are inventive about making small greenhouses. The next thing we wanted was something better than those wire wickets that had held up the inner layer under the early greenhouse. And we came up with what we called quick hoops. And when we first made these, they were just 10-foot lengths of plastic electrical conduit, half-inch electrical conduit, that we would make holes in the ground and just bow them around. And they are covering two 30-inch wide beds with a 1-foot path between them. So a 10-foot length turns into a 6-foot diameter half circle. And if you remember a geometry class, you can calculate that that's just about right. What we found was it was nice to do it with the plastic ones, but we couldn't use these over winter because the snow would bend them. And so we found there was a wonderful guy in Texas making bending forms to build greenhouses. We got him to make one to make these half circles, and this is now sold in the Johnny's catalog. And it's a very quick and easy way to have an extremely inexpensive cover in your garden. And by inexpensive, I mean, there's three of them there next to a 22-foot by 50-foot greenhouse. These three are covering the exact same area that does, but for only 5% of the cost. So this is really an amazing improvement that we can winter over all sorts of crops under there. What's growing in here, and this was the first year we tried it, what's growing in here are the type of onions that growers plant in the Pacific Northwest, Washington and Oregon, onions that you plant in September and harvest in June. Only our climate, like yours, will not permit them to live through the winter. But they will live through the winter in the double coverage of that greenhouse. But then we tried to see if they would live through the winter in a structure that was only costing us 5% as much, and lo and behold, that worked too. Now there's another advantage to this, and this is, again, we were learning so much as we went along. When I first built greenhouses, as you saw in that first big movable greenhouse where I showed you how we had to take the door out of the end when we moved it, I was putting the doors in the ends of my greenhouse because I had always done it. And there comes a time when you're doing new things when you sort of beat yourself on the head and you say, stupid, stupid. Why am I putting the door in the end of the greenhouse and then have to remove it in order to move the greenhouse and put it back in? Why don't I put the door in the side of the greenhouse? And then the whole end wall of the greenhouse, if I put a bar across there, I can put it across high enough so that greenhouse can now roll down over these guys or roll off of them, and I have a roll-up end wall. All of these things were just the type of things, whenever you're playing around with a new idea, you keep seeing more and more ways to make it work well.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Elliot Coleman, owner of Four Season Farm in Harborside, Maine. Extending the season, if we can do it in Maine, you can do it in Alaska, was the title of his keynote address recorded at the Alaska Botanical Garden Conference on March 9th.
Now, that's all the technology. This is the biology. We make as much compost as we possibly can, and I always tell farmers and gardeners, this is the secret. Make as much compost as you possibly can. This is the world's best fertilizer. It's made for free in your backyard from waste products. And I kid people that in a good capitalist society, this should be illegal. That you can actually make the world's best fertilizer for free. Well, you can, and it's what makes things grow. And whenever you have a chance to collect any waste organic matter that is unpolluted, collect it. I had a wonderful old gardening friend in Maine. She used to carry a garbage can in the back of her car wherever she went. And whenever she saw anything that was she could throw in there and take home and put in her compost heap, she did. We make ours on the farm in 12-foot wide, 50-foot long heaps like this. A lot of my neighbors make hay. Whenever they get the hay rained on, I can get the spoiled bales to use as walls. And we turn it just by putting it through my little manure spreader, making a windrow, a very efficient way of doing it. In the greenhouse, we always wanted to have an electric tiller because we'd like to prepare the soil. We found one, and it was just a really poorly made tool. And so I designed one. And I have no time to be in the tool business, but whenever I design tools, I go out and try and find what I call a victim. And a victim, to me, the perfect victim, is the retired engineer with a good shop in his basement or her basement, who has played golf for the last 6 months, is now bored, and is looking for a project. And I found one, and I gave him this design, and he now actually has a small business in Maine with two employees making this and a bunch of other tools. And this is the electric tiller because it's powered by one thing that everybody has, which is the cordless drill. Now, Mr. DeWalt is a heck of a lot smarter. I don't know anybody could put that much power in that little thing. But what we did was just build the little unit that you put that into and come up with that high-tech rope that goes around the trigger and goes up the handlebar. And this is a perfectly delightful little tool. You'll notice that it's going along fairly shallowly there, and it's 15 inches wide, and that's because these beds are 30 inches wide. And people said, well, if you have 30 inch wide beds, why didn't you make a 30 inch wide tiller? And I said, well, when I get down to the end, I have to come back. So it's easy to go down and back, and the small drill can manage this thing. And we made it with that plate on the back, because if you read the research on weeds, the research on weeds tell you that most weed seeds won't germinate if they're more than 2 inches down. So this tiller only tills the top 2 inches of the soil, which makes it easier on a small drill like that, but it's incredibly effective, and we're mixing in whatever soil amendment we might be using in the greenhouse. This happens to be a crab meal fertilizer, waste crab meal that we can get locally. And sometimes we use alfalfa meal. But this turned out to be a great way to get stuff done in the greenhouse. And here's one of our greenhouses in the middle of the growing season. It's an unheated house. Actually, this is in the late fall. We haven't put in the wickets yet. But this is the type of beauty you get. To me, it always looks like a quilt, because our primary crop, other than those carrots, is a baby leaf salad mix, because all of these crops are very, very hardy. when they're just 3 inches tall like that. Young lettuce leaves can freeze every night and thaw every day, and that can go on all winter, and they look absolutely beautiful when they freeze. You take a large head of lettuce, let that freeze 2 or 3 times, and it's mush. So one of the keys to this system is to stick to baby leaves. We put in those beautiful beds with 12 rows to the bed with a simple little tool like this originally. I'm an odd tourist. When I've been in Europe, I don't go to museums, I go to hardware stores, and I find things like this in a hardware store. This was made by a little German company. It's sold by the Johnny's catalog now. This allows you to put 4 rows in 2 1/4 inches apart. The seeds don't come up quite that quickly in reality. And you'll notice that it has an axle with different size holes in there, and these are just press fit wheels. So you can slide the axle side to side so it's under each hopper. And whatever you want to put in, this happens to be radishes in there at 12 rows to the bed. We came up with a improved version of that. This is also in the Chinese catalog, made by the same victim I got to make the little tilther. These are all tools that make it possible to farm intensively in a greenhouse. And by intensively, I mean that another thing people said when we first started with this, well, you can't possibly do this because you can't put crops close enough together to make the greenhouse pay. Well, these are carrots growing at 12 rows on a 30-inch bed. Now, I never would have imagined that was possible, but I have a lot of friends in Europe who have been doing this a lot longer than I have, and I asked them how many square inches they gave each carrot in the greenhouse, and they said 4 square inches per carrot. So I said, if my carrots are in 2-inch apart rows and I have them 2 inches apart in the row, that's 4 inches, square inches per carrot, and they said, right. And that's the way we've been growing them. And they produce at a level of production per square foot that if anybody tells you organic can't feed the world, they haven't been paying attention, because our yields are higher than anybody doing it conventionally. Now, this looks like a strange tool. What this is one of those hand flamers that you see. I'm standing off to the right there with a propane tank on my back. And very often people use these to melt ice sometimes or to burn weeds. What we have done is put a little cover over that and a roller behind it, also 15 inches wide, because when you plant carrots that close together, there's no way you're going to be able to get in there with a hoe and cultivate them. So what you can do with a flamer like this is what's called pre-emergence weeding. And you prepare the bed about a week before you sow it, and then you sow it. And carrots will take at least 7 days before they come up. So on day 6 after you sow it, all the little weeds have sprouted on the surface. You come over with your flamer, flame all those little weeds off, your carrot seeds are safe underneath the ground. A couple of days later, the carrots emerge. You haven't disturbed the soil and brought up new weed seeds, and you can end up with fields of carrots like that, getting high yields by just merely using different techniques to get rid of the weeds. We do all our transplants in what are called soil blocks. I first saw this idea on a European farm many years ago. I thought it was great. And these forms, if you jam them into moist potting soil, like you see there, and squeeze out the blocks, you end up with wonderful little cubes of potting soil that stand up by themselves, don't need any of those little plastic trays that blow around to sit in. They're made with an indentation in the top into which you drop a seed, and you end up with beautiful seedlings. The advantage of these over pots or any of those other things is that if you've ever seen the seedling that came out of a little round pot, the roots are circling around the walls. The studies have been done comparing plants in soil blocks and plants out of little pots put them in the ground. These guys establish immediately. The ones that have been circling around takes about 3 days before they realize they're supposed to go out. These, you can see the little separations between each block. That's just enough so the roots grow to the edge and wait. If you leave them in there too long, they will obviously grow together. We leave our seedlings in blocks like this for 3 weeks before they go in the ground, and then it's a very efficient system. Efficient because we are always finding out simpler ways to do things. We want to put seedlings into that bed at 4 rows to the bed. And so we bought some lengths of P-Tex, this little pipe that plumbers use, and we just stuck them on the rake. And if we go down the bed one way and then across the bed this way, wherever those lines cross, that's where we want to put in a seedling, which is exactly what is happening there. This is a very efficient system because when I send my crew out to transplant, and you could do this with your children working in the garden if you can get them to work in the garden, I just tell them that you want to put these plants in 4-4. And what that means is the first number is the number of empty teeth between each P-Tex tooth when you go down the row. And the second number is the number of empty teeth between each P-Tex tooth when you go across the row. So 6-7 would be different spacing than 4-4. But what this gets you is a nice way to lay out the field, and you come along and drop your soil block seedlings in there. We also do leeks. Leeks in a greenhouse? My gosh, you have to have about 2 feet between each row of leeks so you can get through there with the hiller to hill the soil up against them to get that nice blanched shank on a leek. Well, what about if when you planted them, you made a hole in the soil deep enough that you could take a 10-inch tall leek seedling and drop it into the hole you'd made, and it looked like that. And when you first do this, you can never believe that that's gonna work. There's 9 inches of leek down into the soil there, but you notice I have 3 rows on a 30-inch bed, and I can then, once winter comes, and these things are put in May and they're growing out of doors all summer long, slide a greenhouse over them once they're big enough and we've finished with whatever grew in that greenhouse in the summer. And I was just out harvesting leeks 2 days ago before I got on the plane. They survived. They're amazingly cold hardy, and they survived very nice all winter long, and especially because the key part of them, that 9 inches of nice blanched shank, is down in the soil where not much can happen to it. If you're a leek lover, those are pretty nice leeks. So this is the picture I showed you at the start. And I did want to mention something very amusing here. When we built this greenhouse has a little bit of heat in it. We put pipes, hot water pipes, into this concrete. And there's a little hot water heater over in the corner here, and we can run hot water through there and make that whole floor 70 degrees to get plants started. It's very effective. But because of that, I can do things like growing basil there in March. And I shouldn't, but the local chefs, we sell to a lot of local chefs, they've learned how to deal with people like me. And they don't come and say, Elliot, could you please, grow me some fresh basil for my special dinner at the end of March. They come up to me in January and say, boy, you may think you're good, but I bet you couldn't have basil by the end of March. And I say, what do you mean I can't? So we lose money on all of these things, but it's fun to know that if you want to do it, and if you want to be Maine's largest mango grower, you can. Weeds we control with hoes that we've designed because we never found a hoe we liked. All the hoes have a big blade and they have a 90 degree angle out here. And you will often see in Maine yards a little movable sculpture run by a windmill. And it's a man with a hoe and he's going like this as the windmill bending his back, and that's why your back hurts at the end of the day. We designed a hose, and this is one of them, it's called the wire weeder, that you use standing up. And you'll notice if you look at my left hand in this picture, my thumb is up the handle. You hold your thumbs up the handle when you're holding a broom or a rake. But most people, if they think of a hoe, they think of your thumbs pointing down the handle because you're chopping. Well, this is designed as a razor rather than a chopper. And you'll notice that my feet are aimed down the path, and we design all our hoes. So basically, I'm a tractor. I only have one cultivator, but I'm walking down that path, and I'm just moving this along between here. If I were a tractor and I had six or eight of those behind me, I could be doing two or three beds at a time. The key to this is, do you want to get your weeds while they're small? Once your red root pigweed, I suspect you probably have that up here, gets 6 feet tall, you need an axe to deal with it. But when it was only a quarter inch tall, it's amazing how easily it can be controlled. We also have, this is the collineal hoe, another design. The idea was to put the edge of the blade directly in line with the handle. Again, 70 degree angle, so you can use it standing upright. And there are two people standing upright, comfortably dealing with weeds in a garden. For selling, there are a lot of crops that are easier to sell than others. Kohlrabi is hard to sell, but I think it's a delicious crop. It just isn't exactly that pretty. What we've learned is when we harvest it, we leave that little tiny tag of green on the top, and it makes it look more alive. I learned that from a German grower. I wandered into his greenhouse. He grew a lot of celeriac, which is also one of the world's ugliest vegetables to try and sell. And I noticed he had celeriac sitting side by side down one whole bed of his greenhouse on the surface of the soil. And I said, what's that there for? And he said, I found out they sell three times as well if they have a little bit of fresh green growing out of the top. So I bring them out of the cellar and I send them in here for a week and they sprout a little green. So there's all sorts of wonderful little things to learn. We grow watercress in the winter greenhouse, and this is in a greenhouse where you're putting a little heat, but we do this without a stream. Everybody's saying he has a stream running through his greenhouse. You don't need a stream running through your greenhouse. We have little misters in there, putting out a gallon an hour, and it fools the watercress into thinking it's moist, which it is. I think the light filtering through the plastic makes it think that it's light filtering through water. 1 year when we had a lot of a whole field of carrots that a customer had agreed to buy just before Thanksgiving, and then they backed out on it, we said, okay, a little marketing will do this. If you look at what we did there, this is the Thanksgiving gift pack. We invented gift giving for Thanksgiving. We sold four times as many carrots that week as we had ever sold. The little sign in the stores said, when you go over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house, take her a bag of carrots. It was amazing how that worked. For a while, we were doing what we called the stir fry pack. And for people who like stir fries, this was a turnip, a carrot, a leek, a baby pak choy, a shunkyu pink radish, and a baby tatsoi in there, all in one bag, all winter harvest crops, although the turnip and the radish, you can't keep going much past Thanksgiving. But again, just a fun way to do it. And anybody who's a grower has to compete with California. I was out there at a conference, and they were surprised that there was an Easterner out there growing things in what they called their season, the winter. And I don't let them intimidate me. And I said, guys, I want to tell you something. Do you realize that my taxes are paying for your irrigation water? It's true, we subsidize the irrigation water. I said, do you realize that my taxes are paying to build the highways that allow you to ship your stuff back east? said, do you realize that my taxes are paying to keep the Navy in the Gulf to protect the oil supplies that allow the trucks to do this? I'm sorry, that's all the advantages I'm going to give you. From now on, you have to compete evenly. They weren't used to an Easterner coming out there and talking to them. And also an Easterner who grows artichokes. We grow beautiful artichokes. We aren't supposed to be able to grow artichokes. You could grow them here too. The trick is that they won't make that artichoke until their second year, and they won't make it through the winter. Does this seem impossible? Possibly. But what we found, if we started them in the middle of February in a warm greenhouse, by the time they were 6 weeks old, that was enough time to make them think they'd been through their first summer. We would then move these seedlings to a cold area for the next 6 weeks, which was enough time to make them think they'd been through their first winter. After their first summer and their first winter, they're 2 years old. That was then the middle of May. We would put them in the ground, and lo and behold, artichokes. This was so successful that in order to get even with the Californians, we have thought of renting a large semi-tractor trailer, painting Maine-grown artichokes on the side, and shipping it out there. That this is the main crop from our winter greenhouses. As I said, baby leaves are hardier than the big leaves. And so there's young leaves of spinach in there. This is a thing called bull's blood beet, a beautiful red leaf. This is a Bianca Riccia d'Italio, a cut and come again Italian endive. There's Claytonia. This is a weed from the West Coast mountains that's actually a winter annual, does very well. And lots of other small leaves. This is about as good eating as you can get. I have to mention, we are so much big into making compost that when we bunch something like radishes, we're danged if we're going to ship all that green off, so we cut half of it off the top and keep it here to put in our own compost heap. Oh yeah, this picture's here for another reason. When we started, I remember reading that 25% of the volume in your local landfill was food packaging wastes. And we decided we would not contribute to that. So we cut cedar trees on our farm, took them to a neighbor's sawmill, made our own boxes, got a branding iron made. And when we deliver in these, we get them back from the stores when we deliver new stuff. We wanted to be as much Maine as possible. Maine doesn't produce plastic, but it does produce a lot of wood products. This is pure cellophane, and cellophane's made from wood fiber. So, in fact, it's such pure cellophane, you don't recycle it, you just compost it when you're finished with it. These are our candy carrots, and since we're digging them fresh all through up till the end of February, and the tops are green, we harvest them with that inch and a half or inch and a quarter of green top there so people know they're freshly harvested. Our farm stand, Barbara, my wife, was a professional landscape designer before I married her, and so she does beautiful beds in front. But this picture is here for another reason. We all have neighbors, and it's nice to do neighborly things. And this building used to end right there, but all of the neighbors on our road are artists, and they noticed all these cars coming down the road and into our farm, and they thought, wow, could we attach a gallery to your farm stand for our art? And it was wonderful. 3 years ago, for three consecutive weekends in the spring, they all showed up with hammers and tools, and I built this extension onto our farm stand. This is a fist that I took the carrot out of. It holds a carrot up there, this fist sticking through the roof. And so now, our neighbors, and this is wonderful to work with your neighbors that way. They have a way to sell their art to the people who are already coming to our farm stand. We only sell what we grow. This is the inside of the farm stand in the summer. People are always curious about what sells and what doesn't. We're about as far north as you can do peaches, but we do succeed with peaches. But tomatoes, Tomatoes are responsible for 25% of the gross at our farm stand and at most other farm stands. So if you're curious about how the economics of farm stands go, it's worth having a greenhouse just to grow tomatoes alone. When we go to farmers markets, we have this wonderful little veggie wagon, as we call it, that I built on the back of a just a 5x8 utility trailer. Everything folds up and the awnings roll up, and we run an extension cord out from the towing vehicle to run the cash register. But we can take this anywhere and start a farmer's market, and we have started two, and one of them is just the most wonderful story. First off, when you live in an area, you have neighbors and friends. And this was on an island just south of us. You can reach with a bridge. And there's a wonderful woman there who spends her day picking meat out of crabs. She was my source for a lot of the crab shell fertilizer I use, and I would trade her vegetables. She became a good friend. And on the highway, just past her house, was a pull-off. And we thought, God, it'd be a great place there for a farmer's market. But I didn't know if we could do it legally, so I went and asked Cheryl. I said, Cheryl, would anybody object if we started a farmer's market down there? And she looked at me and she said, Elliot, I'll tell them they ain't going to object. You need to make friends with everybody in your neighborhood. So anyway, we started it there. First week, it was just us with our veggie wagon. The second week, and I almost had tears in my eyes, this little kid with a wagon came along. He had a card table and seedlings in his wagon, and he sat up next to me with his card table selling seedlings from his little home greenhouse. The third week, he was still there, and a lobsterman's wife was there selling fresh lobsters. So this is the American dream. This was just wonderful. These markets grow like that, and that's now one of our most successful markets, and there's about 8 different vendors there. So this has just come out of providing a place for farmers to get together and having Cheryl protecting us against whoever might want to throw us out. And that is winter production in Maine. And the last question on everybody's lips is, but can you do it in Alaska? I've been convinced you can do what we're doing up to the 62nd parallel from everything I've read. But I don't live here. And I'm hoping that this is enough inspiration for someone here to say, you know, I bet I could do that here. Thank you very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with the owner of Four Season Farm in Harborside, Maine, Elliot Coleman. He gave the keynote address at the Alaska Botanical Gardens 6th Annual Conference. Extending the Season, If We Can Do It in Maine, You Can Do It in Alaska, was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on March 9th, 2012, and edited for radio broadcast on KSKA. Special thanks to Patrick Ryan with the Alaska Botanical Garden for recording the event. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.